Welcome to All Things Pilates, Season 4. Though we can't know exactly what Joseph Pilates was thinking or feeling towards the end of his life, we do know he wanted the entire world to practice contrology, and that want has certainly become a reality. Hello everyone, I'm Darian Gold, and here on All Things Pilates, we discuss the man, the method, and how his genius continues to influence and inspire. Second generation Pilates instructors like myself are referred to as such because we've had the privilege of learning the method from one of Joseph Pilates' disciples. But there are a handful of us who have had the opportunity to work with more than one disciple. And one of those instructors is my guest today. Her name is Pat Guyton. Though Pat wouldn't begin her Pilates journey until 1984, she actually met Bruce King in 1976, the first of three Joe Pilates disciples that she would eventually work with. Then in 1992, she met and began studying with the second disciple, Kathy Grant, and then Ron Fletcher in 1995. These three first-generation teachers, among others who studied with Joe, are known to us as the Pilates Elders. Pat is a published author, a Level 3 Franklin Method educator, an alumni board member of the PMA, and spent a decade as a registered physical medicine assistant at Boulder Osteopathic Center. Pat says, there is possibility of change when you know where you are in your body and you are inspired with your mind to reach for a new level of wellness and function. Another Pat-ism that I find very compelling, the hour you spend in the studio is not the most important hour. It's how it impacts the other 23. For those of you who don't know of Pat yet, I'm pleased to introduce her to you. And for those who do know Pat, I'm so glad you're here to welcome her to the show. Hello, Pat. Thank you for taking some time.
Oh, thank you so much, Darian. And I really appreciate that you're doing this and you're giving the whole community an opportunity to share different points of view and to realize we actually have much more in common than we have any differences.
Oh, beautifully put. Thank you for saying that.
You are so welcome.
Pat, in the opening, I talked about your meeting Bruce King even before you started your Pilates career. So how did that happen? Where did you meet him?
Well, and that was really strange. Because I was dancing, my husband at the time was in chiropractic school, so we were living in Iowa, middle of the Midwest, where not much culturally happens, at least at that time. And there was a program called the National Endowment for the Arts, and Jackie Kennedy pretty much spearheaded that under the Kennedy administration. And so different dancers who had companies would be designated as National Endowment artists. And then they had to march out like little missionaries and show people what dance was. So there we are. And at the University of Iowa, we always kept our finger on the button. Who was coming to town? Nikolai came to town. Graham came to town. And then everybody would load up in a car. We'd go to the University of Iowa, signed up for the classes. Well, there was this guy named Bruce King. Now, Bruce is a common name, and King is a common name. And I think there had just been somebody there with one of the dance companies. And it seemed like her mission was to show us how difficult the Limone technique was. And
ooh,
that we
couldn't it was.
and we couldn't possibly do it. And so she gave us these, you know, 30 count combinations across the floor, and we must have looked like doo-doo, but whatever. So here I am, and we're in the car, and we're going to see this guy, Bruce King. We go in the room, And Bruce is there with two other female dancers. He had a small company, at least a traveling company. And he was in his famous orchid unitard and his tights at the time. And we started class, and it was like he wanted us to learn. So there wasn't anything exceedingly difficult. He probably read the class and said, okay, there's these different levels, these different kinds of trained people. And so he taught to his audience. And if you're a teacher, you understand what that means. You can immediately click in and say, oh, we need to move to advanced Pilates, or let's go to the simple things and really emphasize this particular principle. So I can see him in my mind even now doing the Graham step, hop, step, hop, step, hop. And he was talking about angle of the leg, being on the rhythm, being precise. And it was almost, if you're a dancer, kind of ridiculous to do that simple step. So you're looking at him with a certain amount of incredulous, what is this? Where's the things that we can't accomplish? And then he would correct. He was generous. He was kind. And I remember leaving thinking, I actually learned something. That was really worth my time. Then I sort of forgot. Then Pilates started in Boulder. Somebody did a demonstration. And I also...
Wait a second. I'm a little lost. You were in Iowa.
Uh-huh.
And then at some point, you and your husband at the time...
Mm-hmm.
Moved to Boulder, Colorado? Did you open a practice or?
Well, we went to Atlanta and then we went to Boulder. I would say one of the reasons is the kind of practice he had. If you were in some of the, like Atlanta at the time, it was pretty much crack, crack, crack. And he was more into muscle energy, and a city like Boulder is more receptive to that kind of thing. Now it's common.
Right. So now you're in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce King shows up again?
Well, yeah. But what happened is Bruce had another dance partner named Emily Wadhams. And the Pilates comes to Boulder in a gym. One of the things that someone said to me recently, which I think is very important for our audience, she said, you know, those of you who have been studying a long time, even though you had the first generation, she said, you all didn't have any manuals. How did you do it? How were you able to go around? Because those first generation people, they weren't training teachers. They weren't writing manuals. They didn't have tests. They just taught movement. They taught Pilates. So we're doing Pilates. We can call it that. At least we were on reformers. So it kind of looked like a Pilates reformer. It was balanced body. And Emily, this dance partner, Bruce, I think she must have looked at things and said to herself, this is kind of a mess. So she came to our studio. I had the first studio with two other people. We called it the Center Works. And she said, you know, my dance partner in New York teaches Pilates. He has a little studio in his house, his apartment. And he actually lived down the hall from Joe and taught a little bit for Joe. Would you like me to ask him if he'd want to come out? Well, sure, that sounds like a good idea. So this man shows up. His name is Bruce King. But again, Bruce is common. King is common. Light bulbs aren't going off in Pat's head. he walks in the room and I'm like, oh my God. So I make my way up to him because he's in the studio teaching classes to us for the week. And I said, did you have a dance company with like two women? And you were a National Endowment artist? He said, yes. I said, was one of those women named Dale? And he said, oh, yes. And I said, well, sir, I took your dance class at the University of Iowa. It was probably a 3 or 4 day workshop. And then he proceeded to help us with Pilates. And he had that same generosity, kindness. He must have looked at us in great distress and went, oh my God, what is this?
So whether he was teaching dance or Pilates, it sounds like he was a kind man, a generous man, and easy to be around and to follow.
Yes. So at that same time, not only was he in the studio, but his dance partner, Emily, had connections with the University of Colorado. So we had a workshop for the public so that the public would understand what this thing, they thought it was a pilot. They would call up and say, is this pilots? Is this a ground school for airports and people who fly? And I actually had a pilot's license. So that was kind of amusing to me. So we had the workshop for the public. And then we had a workshop for teachers. And I looked at the poster just before we went online. And the workshop for the teachers was $40 for each student. Can you imagine?
Oh.
And $5 for the public.
Wow.
And, you know, I'm thinking this great gift he gave us, he certainly wasn't doing it for the money. So I have an old tape that his dance partner, she's in her 80s now, she found it wasn't curated well. And he's sitting there and he says, I move very slowly and very carefully. Now, some people don't agree with me how I teach, that I move that way. But I think that you need to move with that kind of consideration to really bring awareness into the body so you can make the changes. I know everybody else doesn't do it, but that's what I've chosen to do. And that's almost verbatim because I've watched this thing now many times.
I wonder how Bruce was with Joe, if Joe worked with him at a slower pace and he got to have that kind of experience, because all of us that stood at the bar and tried to break down a tendu, for example, and what was happening in the body. Well, of course, you have to go slow enough so that you can find all those little connections. And it's so similar in the Pilates work because it's as complex or maybe even more complex. So I'm just wondering if Bruce and Joe had a different kind of relationship than, let's say, Carola or Romana, if he just asked him perhaps not to move as quickly or as forcibly, but maybe more thoughtfully.
Well, I always tell this story that Bruce told us because I think it really puts another wrinkle, just like Kathy's experience, and Mary Bowen talks a lot about her experiences. So what Bruce said is he went into Joe's because he had a knee injury dancing. And Joe said in Joe's gruff voice, well, you need to come 3 times a week. And Bruce said, well, I have a dance company and we have rehearsal schedules. And that was Bruce just danced. That's how he made his living. And he lived very meagerly. And Joe said, well, if you can't come 3 times a week, then you have to stay at the beginning program. So he taught whatever he gave Bruce as, quote, the beginning program. Bruce diligently went in and for 5 years, people did the beginning exercises.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So the concentration and the dedication to simply do that. And I guess then Joe walked up in year 5 and said, well, I guess you're ready to move on. So I think Bruce really dug into the method.
Love it. I wish more people would dig in. That's where the magic is.
I think what's happened is when Pilates mushroomed, people clamored to get into studios. Studio owners clamored for teachers. And we of necessity started training good students or maybe people in the community like dancers or gymnasts who had movement education, there were no training programs. So I think it just expanded like that quickly because of an economic necessity, and people wanted it. And it wasn't all bad. It's just what was available.
Moving forward a few years, in 1992, you meet Kathy Grant. How did that meeting occur, and what was it like to learn from her?
Well, and I'm very careful to say the word study to me means over a long period of time. And so as dancers, we always say we studied with, no matter if it was 5 minutes or, yes, you know, 5 years. So I went to a workshop. Now, many people may not be aware that there was an original organization called the Institute for the Pilates Method. And Eve was still in Santa Fe, and Michelle Larson was there, and also a woman named Joan Breibart. And I think Joan had that kind of, she's a businesswoman. So she pushed and said, let's get something together, and invited people to come. Even Ramana went. A lot of people don't know that. And they put out a little newsletter, and I belonged. I paid my money and belonged. And they were doing a workshop, and Kathy Grant was going to come, and it was on the Wanda chair. Well, some of us were buying Wanda chairs because they were being sold by the equipment manufacturers. But again, there were no manuals. There might have been pictures, but really didn't know anything. So it's like, oh my goodness, Kathy Grant's going to be in Santa Fe. And furthermore, she has announced that she will only do this one time, and that's it. Will she do the whole Wanda chair syllabus? So I bought a chair. So this is the funny part of the story. I buy a chair. I know nothing about what's original and what's not original, because this is the chair that they're buying for the workshop. I bring the chair. I get the chair. I experiment around with it, trying to decide, what would I do if I didn't know anything? And then I'll go see what, if there's anything that I came up with that is what was in Joe's repertoire. We go down to the studio, and I know that Rael was there, and a lady named Barbara Huttner, whose name will come up later, and Diane Miller in Canada, and probably many more that I don't remember. We didn't really know each other then. Kathy comes in, and so there's all these new Wanda chairs. But over in the corner is Eve's old rickety. I mean, it was rickety, and the springs were the original springs.
This is Joe's. This was Joe's.
Right. At least one that Clara gave her. But it was a Joe design. So Kathy walks in and says, and I'm not going to edit myself, something to the effect of, what the hell is this shit? And okay. I'm like, what's wrong? I just bought this chair and I spent a lot of money on it. And she takes all these chairs and says, get rid of these things, pulls Eve's old rickety one out of the middle of the room. And that was the only chair that you were allowed to get on. And then proceeded to talk to us about the Wanda chair. That was her first experience with Joe. I guess he looked at her the first day, put her on the Wanda chair, and she stayed there for a year. That sort of belies the myth that everybody does mat and reformer first. And so Kathy was and is still known as the Wanda chair expert. I had an experience with her. I had just had a car accident. So anybody, if you've had any kind of trauma physically and emotionally like that, you're a little vulnerable. So I go down there. First thing Kathy does is she pulls out the lead inner soles that used to go in the bottom of the shoes. So if you think about old ankle weights during the Jane Fonda years, Joe was putting lead weights. Here we were standing on lead. I mean, that's that's real nice to think about. We worry about lead paint. Joe's got lead inner soles. We did have socks on. And so she put them in. She brought different sizes. There were three sizes. She put them in the shoe. And we were sitting on the floor on our sit bones. So you're kind of sitting in think of it as spine twist position. And then you were supposed to lift one leg up with this weight. But of course, most people, their whole pelvis, they posteriorly tilt. Well, if you've studied modern dance, you know how to do this. So I did it. She really liked that. I was really good. So I was feeling like I'm going to get through this workshop just fine. Then we get to the jackknife and she said, would you come up and do the jackknife? So I go up and I'm like, okay, I'll do the jackknife. And I put my legs up to start. She slapped me. And the point was, when you're laying supine, to bring the legs into position to vertical is a movement. And I didn't do that. I knew how to. I just thought you went to vertical and got ready. So then I was a little meek the rest of the workshop. And years later, I talked to Diane Miller and I said, God, Kathy slapped me. I was so vulnerable and mortified. And Diane said, Pat, she slapped everybody. Don't you remember? Wow. But Kathy said some very interesting things. One thing I would like people to consider is Kathy would say the idea, the goal of the Wanda chair is to use the least amount of weight possible to control the exercise, which means that if you're doing tendon stretch or you're doing pull up, you don't want to load it up. You want to actually pull your body up, and the bar gives you the least amount of support needed, the way a gymnast would mount a balance beam.
Yes.
And when you do step up, and step up is Wanda chair, and she was clear that lunge was high chair. And people do not understand that Wanda chair is as different from high chair as spine corrector from high barrel. They are two different pieces of equipment. So on step up, there were two things that really, and I take good notes. She said, you put your top leg here, your foot.
Is it parallel or rotated out?
Rotate on lunge, it's parallel on step up. At least that's what it was for that day in 1992. Maybe she changed her mind. I think we have to remember that they kept growing too. So she said, do not put any weight on the top leg. Pull up the bottom leg with the least amount of springs. Well, now that's physically impossible. You're basically levitating. But she was doing it. I went home and it took me about 3 years to be able to do it. And then I would go around and sometimes the chairs changed of necessity. They became workout chairs and gyms. It would be about 2002. Ron and I were in New York City. We go to Kathy's studio. Later that night, we have dinner. Kathy's sitting to my left. And I thought, God, do I ask this woman anything about Pilates or is she going to just, you know, knock me off my chair?
Did you feel intimidated by her?
Well, the same way you do with any of your teachers, you respect them, you love them, but you want to please them. And also it was dinner. It was really kind of inappropriate. So I was taking a risk. If she had told me to shut up, I'm eating dinner, it would have been okay. So I said, Kathy, could I ask you a question about the chair? I was at your workshop. She said, okay. And I said, did I hear you right? It's in my notes that the goal is to use the least amount of springs possible. And I kept it to the step up exercise, the least amount of springs. And she said, well, yes. And I said, and I heard you say that you should not press your weight into the top leg, but work on pulling the bottom leg straight up. So you didn't go at a lunge. This is what she said. Well, how else would you do it?
She said it like that.
He said it like that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
you got your question answered.
I got my question answered.
It does make sense. It changes the dynamics right away. But for people who are learning in the beginning, they have no clue about where to recruit. You do have to load it. You do have to make it heavier so they don't feel like a loser. People need to have some sort of sense of accomplishment. They're not coming back.
That's right. So remember, Kathy was teaching us as teachers. And I will say this. I suspect that those first generation, they had put in sweat and blood learning Pilates, and they didn't go to become teachers. They went for themselves. They went to learn about their own bodies so they could sustain their careers, whether they were dancers, whatever. That's what people went for. Joe didn't have a formal training program. And so when Kathy was teaching us, I think there was somewhat of an attitude, and not just Kathy, you all call yourself teachers, but you don't even know the basic choreography. So there might have been a little bit of her wanting to show us that we had a long way to go. And so what I did to solve the situation that you described is I would say to my clients, now, here's the goal. So what I want you to do is I would have them go up halfway, let's say, and then I would say, now, I want you to lower and lift and try to move yourself to a place where you almost can't, but you can. And we'll arrange the springs so you can, but you should always feel a little bit like you're at a challenge point, because that's how you grow. So that's the art, I think.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So now Ron Fletcher comes into your life. I thought it was 1995, but you were at dinner with Kathy and Ron was there. So you knew Ron before 1995.
I met Ron in 1995 because he came to Denver and somebody said, Ron Fletcher's coming to Denver to Barbara Huttner. Barbara used to have, she had one of the first studios in Denver, and I believe she's probably retired. God bless her. Because she would bring Ron. So I heard he was coming and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to get slapped again. Ah, can I put up with this? Because we're all sensitive. We all want to do well. We have to remember that about our clients too.
Absolutely.
So I thought, okay, I will take a chance. I will go up there. I walk in the room. And as a dancer, you never would put yourself in the front line, not maybe even in the second line, but respectfully in the third, where you get a good view because you need to learn the teacher's work. And so I was in about the third line with a good, good view of him. And he starts doing his breathing, which sounded like this. And there would be rhythms to it. And I remember thinking, well, this is a little weird, but kind of like the stuff he's doing standing. And he brought a lot of aesthetics, movement, and people would often critique that it was too dance-like. But there was a part of Ron, one of his missions, he would say, I want everyone to feel at least once when they're moving, that they're moving like a dancer, that they have that true joy and bliss. And so I took the first 3 hours. We had a break. What you usually do as a serious student is you go up and you thank the teacher. And so I said, Mr. Fletcher, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Looking forward to this afternoon. And he said, oh, he called me Joy. For some reason, he thought my name was Joy because he had asked in class. And I thought, well, whatever he wants to call me is fine with me. So for about a year, he called me Miss Joy. And that was a joke that we had for the rest of our time together. And he said, well, Joy, you're just like me. And I said, oh, sir, thank you. But what do you mean? He said, we were both well-trained. So I was able to walk in and organize in my head what he was doing because the elements of movement were familiar to me. All I needed to do is see his style, his artistry, how he did it.
So he took what he learned from Joe, and we don't know how long he worked with Joe, but he took the method, and then he infused all of his dance training to create his own program, or would you call it a method, the Ron Fletcher method?
Well, that's interesting because everybody's heard of the trademark, and now we have another trademark dispute, shall we say, going on right now. But at that time, there was serious concern of getting sued if you used the word Pilates. And Ron wanted to protect his students, so he called it the Ron Fletcher work. For a long time, you did the Ron Fletcher work. He preferred his own method of floor work, which is, you could say it was Graham for the masses. So these, we go up to Vail and there'd be these very wealthy women, and they were average age between 65, and there was one that was 92 who did the best roll up. I mean, she looked like Eve Gentry doing a roll up. She was a famous fashion model. So these women would be on the floor and he'd be doing basic Graham, fourth position. Then he'd go into open second by day five. So he preferred to do that. And sometimes people would critique Ron and say, Ron doesn't do a roll up. Well, he didn't do it with straight legs. He did it with his legs. It would be called the Graham seated position. But if you're not aware of Graham, just think of a seal with your leg, your feet on the floor. And that's how he did a roll up, which means he's actually doing short lever. He doesn't have the full length of his legs. And then sometimes he would do it in second, and sometimes he would have one leg out. I said to people, Ron does a roll up, he just changes leg positions.
Yeah. It's a little bit like part of the short spine.
Yes. That's excellent. Excellent. I like that.
Okay. The towel series. Mm-hmm. Ron is known for creating a unique standing towel series. Will you describe that?
Okay. I'm going to describe how Ron would talk about it. Because when I met Ron, we used towels and you were instructed to bring a bath towel that wasn't too thick because you had to roll it up and grip it. And then you would fold it lengthwise in half and lengthwise in half again. And then you would twist it and then you would pull it over the top of your head. Now, they've gone on, even while I was there, to come up with a product that's red because he liked red. And it is a lot more convenient because people would be doing the towel work and the towels would unroll and then you'd have a corner hanging in people's faces. But it was kind of fun. And so Ron said, well, you see, what happened is I was working in Beverly Hills and the women would be standing in the mirror and they would have, I would say,
oh, gee, what a surprise.
Yeah. And he would say, put your arms over your head. Madam, can't you see in the mirror that your right hand is higher than your left one? And he said, so they'd put the left one higher than their right one. And I got so frustrated, I went down to the floor and everybody would have a towel to dry off on. And he said, pick up the towel. He rolled it up and lifted his towel over his head and had the ladies do it and said, could you just keep the towel in a straight line? And so it became a visual cue. Now, Ron once, when he was asked in an interview about the towel work, he said it evolved in and of itself. He said, I didn't pick up the towel one weekend and say, let's see if I can come up with a body of work that I can make a product out of. He said it just evolved. Suddenly then, well, let's side.
There was a need. There was a need and he thought on his feet.
Right. And then it just grew and it became sort of a signature thing. It's a lot of fun. But I also did some research and then I found that Carola Trier, and I think it was 82, published a book called Exercise, What It Is and What It Does for Children. And they were using towels. Bonnie Pruden was using towels. So I have a feeling it's so obvious to do something like that with a straight line as a cue, a visual cue, that probably this has been going on for a long time. But what
the genesis has to be, Joe, because something that Ramana shared with us is that the reason why he used the weighted bar or just a bar to do roll up is specifically so you visually could see if your shoulders were square and level. So maybe that fed into Ron's thinking on his feet because it was already in him. He probably had already experienced that with Joe.
See, I suspect this about all of us, that what, like sometimes, for instance, you'll hear somebody do a workshop and somebody will poke you and say, they didn't give credit to Kathy Grant or they didn't give credit to maybe Elizabeth Larkham. My feeling is sometimes people see so much information. It's in their body. It's somewhere back in their movement history. And they might not remember having seen this. So perhaps somebody was in the studio. I know Ron would be in the studio and Ramana would be there teaching. Perhaps somebody in a corner picked up a towel and did something that Joe did. And maybe Ron and his peripheral vision just took note of it. And then there was a towel on the floor. I just think there's nothing new.
Pat, in your opinion, what makes a good Pilates teacher? Is that a whole show right there?
Oh, gosh. Well, no, I'm going to say one thing first is I remember teaching a really young, talented girl. And she said, I want to be a master Pilates teacher. And I said, you know, you will be. However, the good news is you are going to be because you have that dedication. You know how to study. But I said, the bad news, do you want to hear the bad news? And she said, oh, what? And I said, you're going to be old because you have to do this over a long period of time. And your hair is going to be gray and you're going to probably have wrinkles, but you will do it. And so I think it takes time and experience. I talked to Eve Gentry once and she said, you have to learn the method first. And then with care and consideration, you can change things intelligently for the need of your student that's in front of you. So I think Pilates teachers, number one, we need to have a good solid background. Number two, we need to do the work long enough so we know what that is in our body. Then we need to continue to do the practice so that when we're talking to people, we're not teaching theoretical information that we no longer embody. And then I always say it's an honor and a privilege to be able to teach someone. They put their trust in you. And so we should always strive to do the best that we can and give as much as we can so that the method goes forward. It will always change, but mainly it's that integrity and the heart that the teacher needs.
Beautiful. Then what do you think the responsibility of a teacher should be? What is the responsibility perhaps of the Pilates community at large, since there seems to be fractured?
This goes into something broad, but I think it's very applicable. I mean, we are all being called, and I'm going to get a little emotional, perhaps.
I hear it already.
Yeah, we are being called to become humane. We are being called to be inclusive of people who are underprivileged, people that are a different race, people that are a different color, people that are a different sexual orientation, people that are younger or older. We're working on this and we all like to give lip service. And then here's my Pilates community. And what are we doing but working on separation? Now, I don't say that of all of us as individuals, but as a member of the Pilates community, it is my responsibility whenever I can to drive myself and my friends the communication to how are we alike? Why would somebody decide that this would be a better foot position? Is it because their client base maybe is older and that's what that client base needs? And can I simply say, I notice that you do this a little differently. Can you tell me why? Because I'm interested.
So our responsibility as a teacher that is continuing to learn and evolve ourselves is to stay open to the idea that there are many ways forward. And I know Ramana would always say, you have to look at the body in front of you, and we have to have enough background to look at a body, young, old, black, white, fat, thin. And if we are giving an exercise that somehow you can tell that they are not understanding it and not feeling it in their body, you have to feel like you have the permission and the freedom to experiment and explore with that person, because it isn't a cookie cutter experience. I think some of us have been taught a very specific way, but that way may not be as beneficial to some. And just like you're saying, it's a privilege to work with people, and they're trusting us with their body, with their mind, and with their heart.
And many of them come to us in a vulnerable place.
Broken.
Right. And they want to please us. So we learn how to watch, and we can almost tell. So for instance, we're doing something, maybe even like short spine, and we just sense this is not right for this person today, even if it was yesterday. And they're not going to share that with us because they want to please us. We're all teacher pleasers. And so I'll say, how's that feeling today? Do you think we should move on? Oh, yeah, Pat. Yeah, I think I've had enough of that. But just guiding them along, not saying, oh, that looked terrible today. You don't know what you're doing. Just
or do five more because I said so, opposed to not really watching the body. Maybe they can't do anymore. But they, like you said, they won't share that with you.
No. So we always have to be in active listening. Well, first you have to invite questions, active listening, active reflection, and then positive reinforcement and motivation. One doctor used to refer a lot of his patients to me. And this is what he said. He said, of all the exercises, and I need to preface this, he did something called prolotherapy. So he was an excellent diagnostician, figuring out how to organize the body and treat the body. He's a medical doctor, and he did conferences and wrote a book on this technique. So he said, of all the exercises that I've seen in Pilates, now granted, he hadn't seen everything. He said, the short spine is the one thing that I don't see that you can get anywhere else. That intervertebral motion under the right amount of traction. Now, that's how he described it. And he said, the reason I send people to you, Pat, is not because you'll teach them the short spine. It's because I trust you to know when they've progressed enough to be ready to begin the short spine.
Yes. Excellent. Speaking of proper positions, based on the body that's in front of you. You and I talked about this, and I was fascinated by the history. I'd like to ask you about this foot position that many of us refer to as either Pilates stance or Pilates first, or just heels together, toes apart.
Yes, and I've heard of it as Pilates V.
Or Pilates V. This position obviously shows up throughout the system. And I think one of the questions that I asked you right away was, when Joe envisioned this position, and you'll talk about the historical background based on this, I don't know if he would cue people's hips to then find the turnout in the feet. Those of us who dance understand that. Is it that the legs are still almost parallel, but then the feet are have created that Pilates V? How did this all come about?
Okay. Now, some of this, my husband was a historian, and so I got history lessons all the time. And then I remember Eric Franklin asking a question in one of his workshops. So when do you think people actually started to study movement? And so we're all, you know, thinking, who's going to be there? What, who has the right answer? And people were saying, oh, you know, when we started playing baseball, or it just went on. But eventually you get to the answer, at least back to the Olympic Games. For me, what I think, and I shared this with you, is if you were a tribe, a Native American tribe living out here on the plains, the buffalo weren't just out there day in and day out. The herd might come, and then you have to have the skill to get enough food for the tribe to eat and to put away for the winter. So if there was a young boy out there, a couple of the young kids, and they're starting to maybe use the bow and arrow or whatever tools they had, you're not going to take them out there to scatter the buffalo because they don't have good aim. So I think when people decided that they needed certain skills to survive, whether it was fishing, hunting animals, probably even digging tubers, they had to train to do that. And so I think people have been training physically
forever.
Mm-hmm. So if you go to the history of dance, a lot of ballet, and the terms were French because ballet, it was pretty much a social activity because we didn't have television and they didn't have iPhones, poor souls. So the aristocrats lived like the kings and the queens and the courts, and the peasants were out in the fields, and the castles had moats and walls. So sort of the agreement was the peasants are out there working in the fields, but during the Hundred Years' War, when the enemy came over the hill, the peasants got to go inside and be protected. And then all of those aristocrats who were trained to ride horses and fence and joust, they had to come out and do their job. Now, you just can't sit in the castle for 5 years eating bonbons and walking around having a good time and doing whatever else they did. You had to be training. So I think military training has been going on for a long time. And what would have happened to Joe is, as military training evolved, along with how people conducted warfare, he would have had those skills presented to him. For instance, dressage is now a luxury sport for people who can afford the training and the horses. But dressage was for war. It's how you got horses to line up in rows and stay together and not run willy-nilly all over the field in the middle of battle. So these were just dressage riders with weapons, and they're doing all of this stuff. That took an immense amount of training. I started to look at, I was doing a medical conference, and a doctor came up to me and said, my dad was the athletic trainer for Annapolis, and he brought all these diagrams and copied pages of exercises. Then I went and started to look for old exercise manuals, and I found this one that was 1908 London, and there were pictures of like a circle with degrees and where the heel should be and exactly where the feet should be. And then the knees went over the feet because you're in a boot. Usually they wore boots with heels because you have to have a heel to keep your foot in the stirrup. You have to have a boot or you'll slide out. In order to move sideways when you're fencing, you wouldn't go parallel. You had to have turnout in your hips. So if you've ever I've worked with a fencer and their lunge is It's a deep lunge. It's almost as an extreme turnout as a professional ballet dancer. They only do it on, they have a preferred leg and they're at risk of hip problems. That's why this professional fencer came to me. But that fencing lunge is turned out, then the from the hip, hip over knee, knee over talus, talus over at least second metatarsal. It's that specific and the diagrams are specific. So Kathy Grant would call it a military stance. If you're in the military, you're trained this way. So if you're standing at, let's say, Buckingham Palace, if you stand in a tripod, it's a lot easier to maintain your balance for a long period of time than parallel and certainly not turnout. So I think the extreme turnout would have been used in fencing and then adapted ballet. It was an art form that was designed to kind of imitate what people did, which was martial arts of Europe. The other thing that's kind of interesting, some people might have heard this, but if you ever looked at the pictures of the courts of the Louis and they're in their yellow canary, the men in their jackets that are cutaway jackets, and they're in maybe blue pants and their leg is kind of turned out to the side and they have a heel on it, that is called cutting a leg. And the clothing was designed to show that the men were battle trained.
Interesting.
So I think that our Pilates V, what we need to do, I just taught a workshop on this. We need to teach people how to rotate from the hip, why we want the alignment of the knee under the hip. And we have to teach that.
There you are with the basics that Bruce King did for 5 years.
Yes. Also, I just thought of this. If you look in these manuals, when they lifted the heels, like if you're in a flat foot, Joe's little gymnastic slipper, when you went up, your heels stayed together, like in piano lesson, heels stay together, knees bend. It's not a grand plie. And there are pictures in this manual of that. And I'm looking at it and the man's arms are out to the side. And I'm like, that's the pedipole.
Ah.
So it keeps showing up.
Right. So the idea of teaching in parallel, though, for example, if you had a ballet dancer, all she did was turn out for 20, 30 years, would you just intuitively give her most things that we would do in a small turnout, you would give her parallel?
What I find with people who've been in gymnastics, even martial arts, where they do the big splits, ice skating, dancing, we want to train. I want to give them something they don't get
in their sport or their art.
Yes. So it's called cross training. And I remember Kathy Grant at this particular workshop saying, look, Pilates is not for dance. Do not turn this into dance. Do not make the circles as big as you can. Because what happens is, for me, I became so flexible that my legs could just fall open and I wasn't working to keep them open. They just fell open into gravity. And so for me, I usually, for my own practice, I call it, I rein myself in.
Yes.
Because then I have to work from the hip joint.
Yes.
So that's cross training.
Well, we were always taught to work within the frame of our body. And some people's frames need to be quite narrow because otherwise, if they have hypermobility or they just have a very wide range of motion, it's not going to serve them. So it feels maybe a little inhibiting, but you have to find your center and that containment before you can go big.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, also, I'm so glad you said that because it reminds me that this was the pleasure and the joy that we had working with this first generation. And this is a little aside, but it is our duty to pass on as much of this, not with ego, oh, I got to study with these first generation. It's more like we have a duty to share this with you. So Kathy said, if the dancer just comes into the Pilates studio and does more dance, why bother to come to the Pilates studio?
Right.
There's no point to it. So you would come to Pilates for something you don't get in dance class. And that's our job, to find out what is the weakest link in that particular person so that you can give them strength there. So the sum total of the whole is improved.
Right. Pat, I know you and I could talk at least two more hours. I wanted to ask you about the PMA, the Pilates Method Alliance. You were an original member. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you are you mm-hmm. still an alumni? An alum?
Well, here's something. Okay. So starting at the beginning, the lawsuit was, I think, 1999. I think it was November. Corolla had either passed before the judgment or after, but they had a party, a celebration party. And Colleen Glenn and Kevin Bowen got together and said, we can have an organization for Pilates because now we can call ourselves Pilates teachers. So Ron was there and probably Kathy and, you know, people that really had supported the process of going to court. And every first generation teacher said, can't be done. No point to it. It'll never work. So Kevin, God bless him, stubborn, and he's a go-getter, and he's going to do it. He's got determination, and he said, we're going to do it. So he plans for it in April of 2000. Ron looks at me. I'm traveling around with Ron. I'm his assistant at the time, and I said, so Ron said, what do you think of this, Miss Pat? Well, I know better than to have an opinion about some things. Let them tell me what I think.
It went from Miss Joy now to Miss Pat.
Now I miss Pat. And he said, I was Joyful Pat. That's what I became. I was Joyful Pat.
Wonderful.
And some of his pictures are signed to me, to Joyful Pat. So he said, Miss Pat, I think we need to go down there and just see what's going on down there.
Down where?
Down in Miami. So in other words, he didn't think it's going to work, but he wasn't going to be left out of it.
Okay.
We go down there and every first generation teacher who was still alive, Bruce had passed, Eve had passed, Kathy was there. And he also found Lolita San Miguel and Mary Bowen. Romana wouldn't go, but there was a lot of contention because of the lawsuit, which is why we all need to come together and stop this stuff. Because we could have benefited from Romana and we wanted her yes. there. And we had people on the board, Carol Appel, who had studied with Romana. So there wasn't a exclusion of Romana. So we got together. There were 100 people there. Kevin said, what is it we want to do now? Everybody said, we want to test. And second year, we had some classes. There were 250 people there. What would you like us to do? We want to test. So I was on the board the second year, 2001, and we were Gordon Troy, who had been the legal counsel for the Pilates trademark lawsuit. And Gordon, for those of you who don't know, there's another lawsuit that's happening. Gordon is active on that one too. Thank you, Gordon Troy, because he knows the history and he's fighting for all of us. So Gordon said, in order to have an organization, a 501c6 membership, and to eventually become a 501c3 not-for-profit, you have to have a mission statement that's clear. Well, if you would have asked Ron what that was, he would have had his. Romana would have had hers. And Gordon said, you have to come up with a mission statement that's clear and then support that mission statement. So after a lot of going around the board, the mission statement was to protect the work of Joe and Clara Pilates and protect the public. Now, the protection of the public part may sound odd, but that's a legal thing. Any profession has a duty owed to anybody, any public member who either buys the product or enjoys the service. That is why we have all these insurance things. So we had to put protect the public in there. Then the work of Joe and Clara, what the attorneys directed us very wisely to do is you can only use things that were either written by Joe, articles, books, photos, film, advertising. Joe was a great advertiser for his time. You can't listen to anything, no matter how much we love Kathy and Ron and Ramona and Carola. You can't listen to them because by definition, it's hearsay. It's what they remembered. So that's how that was the PMA's original mission statement. And to get the message out to the public, now that we were able to talk about the word Pilates, sounds like it was a really simple thing, but it was really, really hard. Anybody that serves on a board, and I did a lot of research on this because I was on a committee at one point. Alumni board members usually are acknowledged because we had the history of how this started, and then we served our terms. Healthy boards rotate. Executive directors rotate. Board members rotate. And that brings in new energy. A board member could come back. Your alumni board could always be called up and somebody could say, hey, we have this question coming up again. Didn't that happen back in 2003? What did you all do? Because I still have some of my, I was a secretary for a while. I still have my notes. I can tell you what we talked about. We talked about what are the original exercises? What should be in the exam? What should be the criteria for the bare minimum that a Pilates teacher needs to do to be called a Pilates teacher? That aggravated a lot of people because they said it wasn't hard enough. But legally, in order to get a foot in the door, you have to make it attainable for a certain number of people so that you can grow enough momentum for the exam to have a preponderance of, I don't want to say evidence, but it is evidence that could be used in a court of law. So it is a process, and it is done by what's called a psychometrician and a company that has psychometricians. It is a scientific thing. It is extremely expensive. And the PMA probably spent between $200,000 and $300,000 to do this. And then nobody would take the test.
Okay. When was it completed to then be able to take the exam? When was that process completed?
You know, I want to say around 2004, five. You know, Kevin would know that for sure. The thing is, when you say completed, exams have to grow. For an exam to be legitimate, you have to have at least two copies of the exam that you hand out. This is the same as the SATs. These are all scientifically based. The questions have a scientific way that they're written. And once questions have gone through, let's say, 3 years, then you have to have what's called a committee that does item writing. And so exams grow. And the whole idea was, okay, if this exam seems simplistic, as we grow in a community, then our schools will use the exam so that they include the material that is on the exam, and then we can start raising the bar. It was a hard sell.
And then what happened, or how did that devolve? Did it devolve?
You know, I don't know, because when you're on a board, one of the things that should happen, it always happened with Kevin. I can only speak when I was on the board, but you have to sign non-disclosures, because there is and will be information that is discussed that should not go into the community, and you don't talk about that. It could be as simple as we got this much money, and how much do we pay the attorney, and how much do we pay this doctor who's sitting on the board? The community doesn't need to know that. It clutters up. It's unnecessary. So I'm not on the board anymore. I can't speak to what's going on in the board. I can speak to this. It goes back to our need to be inclusive. Who knows how it happened? I know that Kevin, within the first couple of years, Kevin would say, we need more diversity. For goodness sakes, I'm sitting here at the table and I'm one man and the rest of you are women. We need men. We need people of color. He runs the Human Rights Initiative in New Mexico. This is a guy that's always been inclusive. And somehow we didn't succeed in that. Shame on us. We didn't know how. People didn't feel invited in. So we have Black Lives Matter. I think all of us we're becoming more aware of when we have privilege and how that makes other people feel excluded. I do know that the PMA, like many organizations, Pepsi-Cola, Toyota, whatever, everybody has to step it up. And I know the PMA had to deal with that. I'm not on.
Are you referring more to the board? Or the members?
Board membership, presenters across the board.
And the PMA now has turned towards that direction of this concept of inclusivity?
Well, this is what I would say about that. In my own, I kind of laugh. I have some friends who are diverse and our Pilates teachers, and we speak quite openly and frankly about this.
Wait. When you say diverse, what exactly does that mean?
Anything. Sexual orientation, color, religious background. Black Lives Matter is...
So they're Pilates lovers of all shades and all color and all sexes.
Right. And so I would say what's fair to say about the PMA now is it appears to me from the outside that they are working on this. And the reason I say working is if you are trying to become inclusive, you have to face part of you individually that you don't know participates in microaggressions or just takes your, for me, I'm a white privileged person. That means I didn't even know I was privileged because I was privileged. So there was no reason for me to question why I might have an advantage to be selected to present. I didn't know that. Now I do. And so I'm struggling with that. I'm trying to become more aware in terms of all human rights. So organizations are made up of people like me. So what I would say about the PMA is I can see, like one of my friends who's African-American, she was presenting this year, and this is her first time, and she's just an incredible, lovely human being and deserves to be there. So I would say the PMA is moving forward. How is it going on the inside? I don't know. That's not for me to say, but they need to do more work because I need to do more work.
But underneath all of this is all of our love for Joe's work. And that can't get lost, no matter who we are on the outside. That can't get lost. That's the essence of why we are even in this industry. That can't get lost.
Correct. I do think one thing that's misunderstood is because I work with Eric Franklin and also other functional anatomists, there are people who have brought a little more functional movement. Now, Joe didn't have the opportunity to study that. Osteopathy and Fryett's laws of how the joints work, that was in like 1917. So Joe's back in Europe when he studied movement. Joe also spoke German. English was his second language. If he knew anatomy, he knew it in German, and the words are not the same. So when people bring function in and maybe they say, we're going to move the arm forward into an angle of scaption, that doesn't mean they're dismissing Joe's work. I think it behooves a lot of us to study function, preserve Joe's work exactly as he did it, and when it's appropriate for some people to put their arm, let's say, directly side, do it. But if you have a client that has shoulder impingement or shoulder dysfunction, or they're just plain not able to do it, with care and consideration, to quote Eve again, bring that arm slightly forward. It is a more functional angle. And therefore, there's room for that. There's no reason for us to argue about this stuff.
Those are your parting words, because this is how we started the interview. It's really making all of us have to reevaluate how we operate in our own world and the world at large, trying to preserve Joe's message and be open to having influences that help us take his message forward in a way that doesn't dismiss others.
And Mary Bowen says this, so many times, and so have other people. Ramana changed the work. Kathy added to the work. Do we really think that Joe would have stopped if he died in 67? Do you really think between 67 and now 2022 that Joe wouldn't have another fertile idea? He probably would have invented 8 more pieces of equipment.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Pat, it's been such a pleasure to have you here on the show. If someone wants to contact you, learn from you, come to your studio, meet your beautiful dog, how does he or she do that?
Well, I'm Pat at patguytonpilates.com. I did close down my client business in the studio, mainly because I think my mission now is to work with teachers so I can assist them to pass the work on to their clients. So if you contact me there, Pat at patguytonpilates.com. And of course, you can find me on Facebook.
Facebook and Instagram, the same name?
I have like 2 of them because I have the old studio one. So there's Pilates Conservatory. That's what I call my program. Yeah, just contact me that way. I actually, as one of my friends, she said, I met you at the PMA. And she said, what I don't think people know about you, Pat, is we're all afraid of you first generation, your second generation people. You're unapproachable.
Oh,
and
Lord.
She said, you sat down at the table and started to talk to me like I was a person. And she said, people don't know that you will talk to them. So you can call me up. You can email me. I'll answer a question.
I've been getting that a little lately too. We're still really young. It seems like someone called me an elder. I am so not an elder at all. I mean, I have so much more to learn, for sure.
Do you want to know something about the term elder?
Yes, please tell us.
Well, Kevin, if you're listening to this, I remember that Kevin said, let's call them the elders. Well, I can tell you that Lolita, Ron, Kathy, they did not like to be called elders. They wanted to be called first generation. So I always refer to them as first generation.
Okay. I like it.
But you know what? They're known as the elders and they're not here now. So they can just laugh.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Pat. Thank you so much for your time.
Darian, thank you so much. You do a great service and it was a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. All Things Pilates is produced, edited, and hosted by me, Darian Gold. Mastered audio mix by Fabian Romero. Theme music, Soul Blues Piano Shuffle by Boom Zoom. Recently, I had the opportunity to teach in Madison, Wisconsin, And I'd like to thank Carolyn Holden of the Purple Door Pilates Madison for hosting me. Carolyn is hard at work creating a beautiful classical studio for those who want to learn Joe's original method. By the way, for those looking for a new mat or apparatus class, you're always welcome to join my other students online. Please visit my website to learn more about my classes at dariangold.com. Without sounding disrespectful to the first generation Pilates teachers, those who have come before us, we have to remember that they were all teaching Joe's work just as we are now. They didn't need to be placed on a temporary throne and adulated. Everyone who teaches Joe's work, whether it's his archival method or his methodology that's been adapted to accommodate today's clientele, we all have something to offer. We all matter to our students. Please stay in your own lane and continue to develop your own skill set. Also, try not to forget about yourself and to make time for your own practice, because your students and clients depend on you. They need your strength, your wisdom, your compassion. As always, I remain in awe of Joe's work, and I look forward to being with you again in a couple of weeks for another episode of All Things Pilates.